right, there we go. Wednesday morning Bible study on the book of Acts. We're going to do the first half of chapter 17 today. And for those of you who have been following along on the audio, last week we had a question, actually in both the Tuesday night and Wednesday morning classes last week, about how does Paul verify or prove his Roman citizenship. I don't really have an answer, but for those who are listening on the audio, I know Rich Wandell looked up a little bit and Dale Spencer looked up a little bit, and both of them said the same thing. That is, they must have found the same website.
Yes.
And that is, there was such a thing as papers that would prove or validate your citizenship. Now, you're traveling about, and do papers get lost? Nowadays, modern days, you lose your papers, you lose your passport, you lose your driver's license, whatever. So there was such a thing, but Paul in his situation probably didn't have papers with him. So how did he prove it? Well, there were severe penalties for lying, so that would have helped keep some people honest. But other than that, we don't really have an answer. How did Paul validate his citizenship when he appealed to being a Roman citizen? Okay? So those are a couple of little hints, but we don't really know. Any other questions before we start? Yeah, Barb.
Wouldn't there have been a punishment on the other side too? Like if you claimed that you were a Roman citizen to whoever, and whoever did not believe you, but it turned out that you were, they would be punished.
I think that's true. And that's exactly what happened here in Philippi. So let me kind of recap that just in a couple of minutes, and I'll point that out. I think you're right, Barb. So in chapter 16, we're talking about Paul early in his second missionary journey. So Paul, along with Silas, and along the way they picked up Timothy and Luke, and we know that. And they land in Philippi, the first place they go to on the European continent. And there's no synagogue there. They go outside the city to a place of prayer of Jews, and there they meet and convert, preaching, Lydia, the seller of purple. Yeah, I still love that, seller of purple. She and her family are baptized, considered the first converts on the European continent. And then Paul is followed around by a slave girl who's possessed by a demon and tells fortunes. He gets so annoyed, he casts out the demon, and then the owners are so upset, their loss of gain, that they drag Paul and Silas before the magistrates and make some false accusations. So Paul and Silas are thrown into jail, so this is the whole event of the Philippian jailer, which is fairly well known in the church. It comes up in our lectionary and all. And at midnight, the jail is miraculously opened. The jailer is about to commit suicide because the penalty for him for losing a prisoner is death. And they say, no, stop, don't commit suicide. We're all here. And he hears them preaching. They were singing hymns. The jailer ends up being converted. He and his family are baptized and he treats their wounds and, you know, things seem to be going well. And the next morning the magistrates realize, we never really convicted him. This was wrong. So they send word that they're free to go. And that's where Paul appeals to his citizenship. He says, I'm a Roman citizen. This was wrong. You condemned me without a trial. You need to come down here and apologize.
Wow.
Imagine that. And so they did. It says the magistrates came down and they apologized and then they asked them to leave. It specifically says requested them to move on. So, we're sorry, we shouldn't have done that. Can you please go away? And I think the reason for that, Barb, is exactly what you just brought up. Because if a higher up, a governor of the region, came to this town and realized the magistrates improperly condemned a Roman citizen, they would be in trouble and probably jailed themselves. So yes, there'd be a punishment for them. So once they find out Paul's a Roman citizen, they come down and apologize and try to scooch him on. Move on. All right? Sound familiar? I gave probably a longer recap than I needed to. So let's go to Acts chapter 17. So chapter 17, first half or so. Verse 1, now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Now first of all, we don't know much about Amphipolis or Apollonia. When we were on our Greece trip recently, let's see, there's a few of you in here that were on the trip. We drove through them, those areas, on our way from Thessalonica to Philippi. And was one of those two places the place we stopped for a little rest area, bathroom and coffee? I don't remember. So probably, I don't know, it was what, maybe a three-hour drive on the bus from Thessalonica to Philippi? So it might have been about a three-day walk for Paul. So probably these two little villages that are mentioned were stopover points for Paul and his group. They would have stopped and gotten some food, maybe spent the night, and then continued their journey. Would Paul have preached there? Probably, but we really don't know much about either of these places, even from early church history. So they pass through those two places. They end up in Thessalonica. Now, Thessalonica was the largest city in Macedonia. Macedonia back then, which today is northern Greece, but back then it was like a separate nation state and separate region, a separate area. And Thessalonica was the biggest city. And it was big enough that there was a community of Jews and they had a synagogue. Okay? So, verse 2, Paul went in, that's his habit, right? He goes to the synagogues first. Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus, whom I proclaim to you, is the Christ." Now the Scriptures they had at that point was only the Old Testament. Paul's letters hadn't been written yet. The oldest book of the New Testament, we think, is James. James may have been written, but not yet disseminated. I don't remember the dates. The Gospels have not yet been written. Okay, we're only like 15 years after the resurrection here. Keep this in mind. Okay, so the Scriptures he has is the Old Testament. Now, do the Scriptures point to the coming Messiah?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, all through them. It's all the way through the Old Testament about the coming Messiah, the Savior. Do these Old Testament Scriptures and all the places where they point to the coming Messiah, does it also talk about the Messiah having to die? And maybe a hint at the way he dies?
Yes,
it says, "They pierced my hands and feet," in the Old Testament, I think in Isaiah. That's unusual because the Jews executed by stoning. So that's a hint in the Old Testament to the form of death that the Messiah would suffer. So what is he doing here? Paul, remember, he's an highly educated Pharisee. So he's taking the Scriptures that they have, the Old Testament, which frankly is sufficient. It is a little hard to understand because a lot of it is prophetic. But it is sufficient to point to the coming Messiah and the necessity to believe in him. And what is he doing? Verse 3, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer. Remember the common mistaken thought by the Jews at that time? Jesus' own disciples. What did they think about the coming Messiah? He's going to be a king, and an earthly king. And, you know, they asked him a few times after he rose from the dead, "Oh, are you going to restore the kingdom of David at this time?" They thought he was going to be an earthly king. There were some faithful Jews around who properly understood. But the common misunderstanding within Judaism, before and after the time of Christ, was that the Messiah would be a king. So Paul here now comes to his senses after his, you know, conversion on the road to Damascus. He's explaining and proving, no, the Christ, that's a title for Messiah, the Christ is going to have to suffer and die, but then rise from the dead. And he proved it from Old Testament Scriptures. And by the way, the Christ has already come. It's this man, Jesus of Nazareth. He came and fulfilled the Scriptures, died and rose again. So, he's doing all of this over three Sabbath days. So 2 weeks. You think some of the Jews might have started getting annoyed? Probably. What is this guy doing? He's invading our services, you know, in the synagogue. Okay, verse 4. And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks and not a few of the leading women. Okay, there's a couple of things to be to be learned from this as well. So there is some success. Remember the overall theme of Acts is what happens with the gospel. The volume 1, the book of the Gospel of Luke, what is the gospel? Volume 2, the book of Acts, what happens with the gospel? Well, the gospel brings about with it both success and conflict. You're going to see that right here again. Okay? So there's some success. Some of the Jews did believe, a great many of them, it says. And also, some of them believed, but a great many of the devout Greeks. So these are Gentiles who along the way, we've seen this a few times already, Gentiles along the way who've come to realize, oh, this Yahweh that the Jews worship, that really is the true God. So they're like hangers-on to the Jewish faith, but they've not converted to becoming Jews. Okay? And then also it says, and not a few of the leading women. Now why might Luke have said that here in the book of Acts? Not a few of the leading women. Pardon?
Does it mean many?
Well, it does mean many. But why women? Why does he mention women?
Because culturally they didn't mean much.
Yes. I think this is showing inclusion. Jewish culture set men a little step above women. Right? It took the testimony of two women to equal one man. That's how their attitude was. That's not from the Bible, by the way. That was just kind of their own chauvinism. That also is reflected in Greco-Roman culture. In Greco-Roman culture, land-owning men were the highest category of citizens. And then next below that would be women, their wives or family. And then down below that, the lowest category of people would be children. And then below that would be slaves. Okay, so there was a bit of a hierarchy in Greco-Roman culture regarding the status of people. I have had some people, students actually, that were asking about men and women and, you know, Christianity, and I said, actually, Paul is the first one I think of that prominently elevated women to being the equal of men, spiritually speaking. He does that in a number of his letters. He does that here in Acts. He points out that when it comes to spiritual matters, when it comes to religious faith, women are equal to men. They receive the Holy Spirit. They have faith the same as men. They are equal in the eyes of God. Okay? So really, equality between the sexes, the genders, and yes, there are only two.
Yes.
I think it prominently started in the Christian culture. Okay? Right here.
What about the slaves?
Paul acknowledges the existence of slaves because he tells them, like when he writes in Philemon, for instance, and also in his books to in his letters to Timothy and Titus, if you're a slave and you can obtain your freedom through working out your freedom or through buying yourself to be free, do it. But if not, obey your master and be loyal to them and do your work and do it faithfully. So that's not Paul condoning slavery, but he's acknowledging the existence of slavery and also pointing out that we need to rise above slavery, which over time happened. Yeah. Okay? Questions? Comments? All right. Well, let's go on then. So, there was some success. Verse 5. But the Jews were jealous. The Jews were jealous, and taking some wicked men of the rabble, they formed a mob, set the city in an uproar, and attacked the house of Jason, seeking to bring them out to the crowd. Okay. So, the Jews are jealous. Now, when it says Jews here, and if you look at the footnote, it actually says the Jewish leaders. So, but the word is Jews. So throughout most of the Gospels and the New Testament, when you see the word Jews, it's usually a reference to the Jewish leaders. Okay? So they're jealous. What are they jealous of? Paul and Silas taking their people away. Right? You know, I'm a leader of this synagogue and we got 200 people here and, you know, that's kind of prestigious a little bit among the Jewish community. And you're taking half my people away. They're jealous. I think jealousy usually leads into greater and greater sins. What's the difference between jealousy and coveting? Or are they the same? Jealousy and coveting. What's that?
Both.
I think they're very, very close. Maybe the same. And you guys realize, you know, just a little bit of a side thought, the Ten Commandments do have an order. The first commandment is the most important. You shall have no other gods. You break any of the other commandments, you commit any sin, you are having another god. You're breaking the first commandment as well. And then usually we look at the last two commandments, you shall not covet. And we say, well, that's a pretty minor sin. It's just a sin of the mind. Nobody even knows you covet. Nobody but God would even know that that's a sin. But the problem is coveting or jealousy leads to bigger sins. The perfect example is King David. He coveted or was jealous of Bathsheba. And what happened? Bigger sins and bigger sins and bigger sins until the prophet Nathan had to call him out on it. Okay? Also, another example with the Jewish leaders, what did Pilate come to realize? It says it in the Gospels. When the Jews brought Jesus to him, and Pilate said what?
The Jews were jealous.
Yes! This man is innocent. He realized that. And the only reason that he was brought to him, Pilate, was because the Jews were jealous. It was jealousy that caused the Jewish leaders to arrest Jesus and bring him to Pilate. So there again, jealousy leads to a lot of problems. Here too, right? The Jews were jealous. What would you say is the opposite of jealousy or coveting?
Wishing goodwill for someone.
Generosity, yeah, that's
generosity.
Good.
Contentment.
Contentment, yes. Contentment with what you have. Generosity with what you have towards others. Yeah, that's what we how we should live. I have come to realize, and I bet all of you are in this same mindset as well. When I was a young man, I really wanted a sports car. For a while, I wanted a Fiero. Remember that car?
Oh, yeah.
It was a little dart of a car. And I had an uncle who at the time, he's since retired and passed away, but he worked for General Motors at the Warren Tech Center, not far from where I lived in Sterling Heights. And he had a Fiero. And I wanted to buy it from him, but I didn't have the money, and I just had a minimum wage job, and I couldn't afford it. Then I wanted a Dodge Viper.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
I thought,
remember that car?
I thought you wanted a Viper.
Yeah. You know what my attitude is now? I want something that runs reliably.
Yeah.
I really don't care what kind of car it is. I just want something that runs when I turn the key on. That's what I want.
Yes.
My attitude has completely changed over the past decade or more. Well, part of that might be the ministry, being a pastor.
Yeah.
All right. I bet all of you are in that situation too. Because as you gain experience, as you gain perspective, you realize what's really important. And what's really important is not a fancy car or having a boat or going on, having a fancy house or fancy trips or whatever. What's really important are the relationships you have, the family you have, and most especially faith in God, faith in Jesus. You come to realize what's important. Okay, little side trip there.
As
yeah.
a woman, when I was young, I loaded my face with all kinds of beautiful cosmetics.
Well, sure.
And now I care less. I'm old and full of wrinkles and what? Who cares?
Well, younger people are usually more obsessed with their looks, their fashion, their looks. You know, they want to. And then as you gain perspective, you realize, you know what, that doesn't really matter. As long as I look respectable, I'm fine. The rest doesn't matter, right? All right, so where were we? Oh, they formed. So these Jews are jealous, so they form a mob. Now, can you control a mob?
No.
I have never personally been exposed to a mob or seen a mob, but, you know, you see them on TV even nowadays. You'll see mobs attacking something. There's no controlling of it, and the people are driven by just sheer emotion, usually anger or hatred. And so here's this mob. Who's going to control it? Where do they go? They go to the house of Jason. Now, we don't know anything about Jason. We never hear from him again or about him. But he must have been the host where Paul and Silas were staying, much like Lydia in Philippi. Okay, they would often have a host that would keep Paul and his group. So they must have been there seeking to bring them out to the crowd. And when they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brothers before the city authorities, shouting, let me scroll down here, hang on, shouting, "These men who have turned the world upside down have come here also. And Jason has received them, and they are all acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus." So they couldn't find Paul and his group at the house of Jason. Well, probably what happened. It doesn't say it, but it's a very likely speculation. You can hear the mob coming. So Paul and his group snuck out the back door, went down the alley, and went somewhere and hid. Okay, they know what's happening. You're not going to stand there and just let a mob, an unruly mob, take over. So they sneak away. But Jason is still there. So they drag out Jason. Where are these guys that were with you? We want them. They dragged out Jason and some of the brothers before the city authorities. Well, here we go again. And what is their accusation? Mostly false, right? Is there a smidgen of truth in there? Yeah, maybe. That's how the devil works, by the way. He puts a smidgen of truth, a grain of truth, surrounded by a bunch of lies and exaggerations. So first of all, these men who have turned the world upside down have come here also. Have they turned the world upside down? No. Kind of?
Kind of, yeah.
A little bit. They're preaching Jesus. And those who have hear about Jesus and come to faith, does that turn that individual upside down?
Yes.
Yes. But is it turning the whole world upside down? No, it's not undermining the authority of the Roman government, but it is turning people upside down. So here's the way that I would recognize this. Maybe some of you have had this happen to you, especially if you're teaching somebody, a young person. They have some preconceived notion in their mind, and I'm just kind of picturing, like with confirmands in my case. And so I'm teaching them and pointing out some things, and you can all of a sudden see something click. This can happen between family members or friends and neighbors as well. Maybe they're asking you questions about God or religion or the church, and you're answering as best you can. Something in their mind clicks. It starts to make sense. And you can see them pause, and their eyes go up, and they're like thinking about it. And you can almost see on their face that their worldview is changing. Do you know what I mean? Have you guys experienced that before in someone you've talked to? I have. And so that's like that person's mindset, their worldview is thrown upside down, is changing. In the case of exposing that person to God and to Jesus, that's a good thing, that they're being thrown into turmoil mentally, internally. That's a good thing, okay? So here, what these men are saying, I would say there's a smidgen of truth there. They're turning individuals upside down by preaching the word, but they're not throwing the world into rebellion. And Jason has received them. Well, that's true. He has received them. So what were to happen if our government were to turn anti-Christian and start persecuting pastors, and I see it coming, so I go kind of escape and hide away so that I'm not locked up and can keep preaching the gospel, and then the government comes after you. But you've supported that Pastor Measle. We're trying to find him. We can't find him. But you guys, you supported him and the church he was at. So we're going to arrest you by association. That happens still in the world today in places that are anti-Christian. Okay? That can be a scary thing, that you're convicted just by association. And they are all acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus. Now this again is a falsehood and a complete misunderstanding. Is Jesus king? Yes, but he explained to Pilate, and Paul knows this. Paul's explaining this too. Jesus is not an earthly king. And Paul, throughout his letters, he advocates obeying the Roman laws as much as you can, except where they would tell you to worship false gods. So, no, they're not saying Jesus is another king as opposed or against Caesar. That's not what they're saying. So this, again, is another false accusation. Okay? Thoughts, questions, comments real quick? Yeah, Jeannie.
But Jesus is already dead, right?
Yeah.
So he wouldn't be a threat to him. What would it matter?
That's a good point. Even if they're making this false accusation, Jesus is already gone. So why do they care that Jesus supposedly is another king? But that's not what they're declaring, but nevertheless. You're right. Yeah. Jesus has already ascended into heaven. He's not on the earth anymore. Any other thoughts or observations? Yeah, Don?
People that follow Jesus are loyal to somebody else other than Caesar now, basically.
Well, that could cause a little angst among the Roman government. Somebody has their loyalties to a higher power than the Roman government.
Yeah.
Does that happen today? People want the government to be the highest form of authority? you know, people who worship the government?
Until you don't like what it's doing, and then...
Well, then the other side doesn't want to... Right. So one side wants to worship, then the other side wants to worship the government and what they do. Yeah, right, right. That's happening all over. All right, so false accusations. And the people and the city authorities were disturbed when they heard these rumors. So this is a mob talking. How much can you really believe them? But nevertheless, it's causing an uproar, and the authorities are disturbed. Verse 9, and when they had taken money as security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. Oh, what is that called? Bail, right. So see, bail existed all the way back then. They said, all right, you're not directly involved, but you've been complicit to helping these men, you know, create this uproar, so you need to pay us, and if you want your money back or a portion of your money back, you need to tamp this down. You need to quiet this down. Okay? Yes, there's a bail there to let them go. That's kind of funny. Not funny, but funny. All right. Continuing on. So verse 10, the brothers, so this means the Christians, and yes, the word is brothers, although the footnote will say brothers and sisters. It means the newly forming church, the brothers, immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. And when they arrived, they went into the Jewish synagogue. So Paul and Silas, and we come to find out Timothy too, they go to the next town west, Berea. Now in Greek it was pronounced Berea. So I don't know if that confused some of us on our trip to Greece, because we were there, and she kept saying Berea. Well, that's the Greek pronunciation. So Berea. So they go to Berea, which is a much smaller town, and it's a day's walk to the west. And when they arrived, they went into the Jewish synagogue. It's a big enough town that there's Jews there with a synagogue. Verse 11. Now these Jews were more noble than those in Thessalonica. They received the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. Well, this is interesting. How would you like to be described as being noble? I think that's a great compliment. I looked this word up. I did a little study on this. I looked this word up. I didn't write down the Greek word, although it doesn't really matter anyway. But the Greek word means noble. This is exactly the right translation. And in the Greek, by noble, it can mean one of two things. Noble can mean of a family of nobility, royalty. So like in Middle Ages, you were of a family from a duke, a count, an earl, something like that, nobility. So, you know, a notch below the ruling authorities, you're noble in terms of your family heritage. Or, it says, the word noble can mean high-minded or open-minded. Noble. Would we describe somebody that way as noble? Maybe. So they're more noble. What does that mean? Open-minded. They're willing to consider properly, seriously, what Paul is saying. And what do? They receive the word with eagerness, examining the scriptures daily. So they're saying, oh, Paul is telling us about the Messiah, that the Messiah must suffer. Well, let's go look it up. We've got our scriptures, the Old Testament. They look it up. Yeah, he's right. And he says, this Paul is saying Jesus is the Messiah. He fulfilled all these prophecies. They look it up. Yeah, I guess he's dead. That's true. Luther makes the comment, would that all Christians were like the Bereans and searched scriptures to make sure that it was so. I have had some people comment to me sometimes, and I don't take it as a criticism. They don't mean it as a criticism. But just a couple of times I remember somebody saying to me, and I think it might have been after a Bible study, well, Pastor, you talked about this and that, or that topic, or this topic. I'm going to go read that chapter, or go look that up in the Bible, just to be more understanding of what you were talking about. Well, I could take that as an insult, or a criticism. I don't quite trust you, Pastor. I'm going to go look it up for myself. I don't take it that way, though, on purpose. I say, good, go look it up. Go validate what I'm saying is true and see for yourself. It'll make you stronger in faith and make you more understanding of this particular topic or issue that we're teaching about. Okay? Luther encouraged that. That's why he translated the Bible into German. You realize before the time of Luther, the Bible was only available in the Middle Ages, in the Central European places, in Latin. And that was on purpose, because the church felt that people, everyday people, should not read the Bible. Because you have to have somebody else explain it to you. You cannot read it for yourself. You won't understand it. So, actually, the church of the Middle Ages forbid translating the Bible into other languages. Luther got in trouble for translating it into the vernacular, German. That was another nail in his coffin, that they sought to arrest him and put him on trial, because he did this, translated it into German. But Luther said, no, people should read it. You should be able to read it for yourself. Validate what we preach is true. That's okay. I try to have that attitude as well. So they received the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. What a great thing. To read scripture and examine it and double check it. Okay? Comments or questions from anyone? Thoughts? I'm lecturing too much. We need some discussion.
Your comment about noble being open-minded or high-minded.
Yeah.
The Jewish authorities in Thessalonica. Oops, Thessalonica. It's not Nike, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you can say that. In Greek, they pronounce it Thessaloniki. That's how it's pronounced.
Were high-minded, meaning that they were the authorities that knew the answers.
Well, yes.
Open-minded in Berea being... Noble in Berea being open-minded was looking at all of the possibilities.
Yeah.
To me, those are different. Two different.
Yeah. In my mind, I think of high-minded as meaning you set your mind on things above, on bigger topics, on visionary topics. Instead of being dredged up in the details, you say, I'm going to look at the bigger picture. That's what high-minded means to me. Although I can understand how just the phrase high-minded might come across as meaning arrogant. So yes, the Jews in Thessalonica were arrogant versus the Jews in Berea were open-minded. There, I'll avoid the word high-minded because there's a little bit of difference of understanding of that phrase. Yeah, so let's think of noble here as meaning open-minded. Yeah. Good. Yeah, and?
When my father-in-law... to Ontario for the second time as a pastor, they were at a church in Godridge, which is on the Huron, Lake Huron.
Okay.
And they had to come up with a name for the church. It was a mission congregation. And what he steered them to was Berea by the Water, Lutheran Church.
Okay.
And his hope and his goal was to be teaching, and that the Christians there, the Lutheran Christians there, would be studying God's word.
Yeah. You know, when I confirmation is coming up this coming Sunday, late service. Some of you already know that. If you don't, now you know. One of the things I try to emphasize with the confirmands right near the end of the class is, why are you Lutheran? What's unique about Lutherans? Can you be saved and go to heaven by being a Christian in a different denomination? Well, yes, you can. So what's unique about Lutherans? And I point out to them a few things. First of all, Lutherans are focused on, obsessed with, Jesus. We don't talk so much about the Holy Spirit. We don't talk so much about the sovereignty of God the Father. Yes, we recognize those things. But we are hyper-focused on Jesus and what Jesus did for us. Secondly, I say Lutherans, the Lutheran Church in general, but especially the Missouri Synod, we're focused on searching scriptures to make sure we're teaching correctly. Sometimes it causes us some problems because we get down in the weeds and argue about little details of doctrine. But we want to make sure we're teaching correctly, I think more so than other denominations. Mm-hmm. Other denominations, if we're teaching wrong about the Lord's Supper, we're not so bothered by that. In fact, I have heard from people. Actually, no, I haven't heard from people. I looked at it myself on the chapel, their website, okay? And I drilled down into their website on baptism. We've had, over time, a couple of times, some people have left our church and I know go to the chapel for different reasons. So what do they teach? Well, they're evangelical free is their denomination that they would claim. And what is that church teach? If you drill down into it and you go to the website and all, it'll talk about what you believe about baptism doesn't really matter. If you want to be baptized as a baby, that's fine. If you want to wait till you're an adult and you give your heart to Jesus, that's fine too. And I'm thinking, like, both of those are not compatible with each other. So they basically up front say, we don't think the teaching about baptism is that significant. It doesn't matter. And I'm like, wow, that's, you know, Lutherans, yes, a little bit to our criticism, we're obsessed with teaching correctly. We want to have things correct, like the Bereans. So we are constantly making sure, trying as best we can to have correct doctrine. Yes, sometimes it causes us a little misguided focus, perhaps. Okay? I'm kind of proud of that, actually. I take that as a badge of honor. Yes, we want to teach correctly. All right, other questions or comments so far before we go on? Bob, is that regular coffee or decaf?
It is regular coffee.
Okay, all right, just making sure. I mean, more of you need to drink coffee.
Well, now I'm wondering if denominations that have that kind of an attitude toward baptism, if they also have that kind of an attitude toward the Lord's Supper.
Oh, yes.
That it doesn't matter whether you believe
Correct.
In the real presence.
Same attitude towards the Lord's Supper, yeah.
Or not.
Doesn't matter what you believe, right. Which is dangerous.
Right, yeah. I would also say, and this is something that's dear to my heart, as a Lutheran and as a church musician, that in our church, the relationship between theology and music is very, very close. And, you know, the music isn't just something to make people feel good, or because if you look at our hymns, especially our hymns of Lutheran origin, you know, they support
the
doctrine
and
the teachings.
Yes.
The teachings of the church.
Yeah, we actually look at the content.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That is one thing that they really stress at the organist workshops at the seminary in Fort Wayne.
Okay.
And I used to go to those.
Sure.
And, yeah. And I think I knew it. I mean, I think I always knew that because when I was in parochial school, of course, we learned, and the hymnal was all we had. We didn't have all this other stuff.
Right.
So we learned the hymnal
right.
and the hymns and memorized so many of them and so on. And I think I always realized the relationship, you know, but I never really thought about it
sure.
that much until...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I agree. Yes, the content is important. That's right. All right. Move on. Verse 12. Many of them therefore believed, with not a few Greek women of high standing, as well as men. See, here again, Paul is mentioning women. He's elevating them from a spiritual standpoint, from a member of this new young church. They're equal to men here. Okay, not a few Greek women of high standing, as well as men. Now,
the order is reversed here. I wonder if that's significant.
I don't know. You're right. That's a good question.
Yeah.
Yes, Jeannie.
How can he keep saying not a few?
Yeah, instead of saying many?
Yeah.
I have no idea. Just a rhetorical device, I guess, just a way of speaking. You know, I hear that on news stories, or I'll read it, you know, on news articles online where they'll say, not a few, or, and I keep thinking to like the newscaster or the person, the news, the journalist writing the article, why don't you just say many? Mm-hmm. What, you know? Well, here's another one. Here's a common one. So we're into a little grammatical stuff. You guys know that I have a little bone to pick with the misuse of the word literal
yes.
and figurative.
Yes.
People misuse that all the time.
I hear that word.
Oh, I was,
time.
That made me so mad, it literally blew off my head. No, you didn't. No,
yeah.
You didn't. That's not literal. Another one is, I don't disagree. You heard people say that before?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I don't disagree with that. Well, then why don't you just say you agree? Yeah, yeah, there you go. I don't know why he says not a few. I think it's just a style of speaking. But here's another thing, too, that this was in the Lutheran Study Bible. Some of you have the Lutheran Study Bible. So one of the footnotes in there says, why is it appear that women are more... willing to convert than men? Why are women more readily converted, it appears? That's kind of the implication here. Well, I think a few things. One of the things that mentions in the footnote in the study Bible is that there's some obstacles for men. Why would these leading Greeks, why would the Greeks not become Jews? Well, first of all, if you leave... and become a different religion, a lot of times your inheritance was at risk. You know, if you join a different religion, your family might ostracize you, might shun you. That still happens today in Muslim communities. It happens in Amish communities. If you depart from the faith, your livelihood and your family relationships are at risk. Another reason that Greek men would be reluctant to convert to Judaism and therefore maybe also Christianity is circumcision.
Oh,
I don't want to do that. I'll just kind of be a hanger-on the edge. I don't want to do that. So a few different reasons that there might be some obstacles. Personally, I think it's just, we can look and say in our churches, and not just Lutheran churches, all Christian churches, there's generally a higher percentage of women than men, right? Mm-hmm. Why is that? Somebody last night said, because the men die.
Those
widows.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That might be part of it. But I do think, truthfully, women are a little more in touch with relationships, with people. Men are a little bit more focused on stuff, objects, building things, you know, our vocations, etc. Women are a little more in touch with people and relationships, the nurturing aspect of women, you know, with families and kids, etc. So I just think there seems to be a little more propensity for women to be open to converting to the faith than men. Okay? That's just a supposition or a guess on my part. I don't know. Yeah, Jeannie?
And it says women of high standing.
Yeah.
So they would get to go and listen.
Yes.
Where the other women would be working.
Perhaps. Yes. So these are women of money or influence or higher higher class level, and so they maybe have some free time, and so and they're maybe also more influential. And if a woman is converted, can she then talk to her husband and try to get him to convert? Yeah, that's a possibility too. So it's a good thing. Okay? All right, verse 13. Oh, here we go again. Success and conflict. Verse 13, but when the Jews from Thessalonica learned that the word of God was proclaimed by Paul at Berea also, they came there too, agitating and stirring up the crowds. So trouble follows them. A troublemaker, if you leave a bully and depart from there, does the bully sometimes follow you? I mean, just think of childhood playgrounds.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
What? Oh, yeah. Give me 5 minutes, okay?
Sorry, he's supposed to come talk to your class.
I'm going to go talk to the preschool. We're almost done. We're going to do two more verses.
So,
a bully will follow you. Because they're not happy to just, you know, drive you away. They want to dominate. So they're going to keep following you. So, Berea is one day's walk west of Thessalonica. So Paul and his group go there. They start preaching. They have some success. Somebody is traveling in that direction from Berea to Thessalonica. Word gets carried over there. The Jews come back and they're like, oh, we're not going to stand for this. We don't like that. We drove Paul out of here and now he's over there preaching. We don't like that. So they go there and stir up the crowds again. So verse 14, then the brothers immediately sent Paul off on his way to the sea, but Silas and Timothy remained there. Those who conducted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and after receiving a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible, they departed. Okay, so the brothers. So here it's some of the new converts, the new members of the church, not Silas and Timothy. So why, first of all, is it only Paul? Probably because Paul is the spokesman. He's the one doing most of the preaching. He's the lightning rod for the trouble. So they're going to sneak him away. And then it says, on his way to the sea. What does that mean? Now, those of you on the trip in Greece, you know, when we went from Berea, you can kind of go due south on land and get to Athens. We zigzagged a little bit, and we went to Meteora and Delphi, which are beautiful but not biblical, and then ended up in Athens. So to go to the sea, you got to go out to the sea, and you sail down, and then you got to come back into Athens. So I was wondering, why does Luke say on his way to the sea? So I looked it up in Dr. Lenski's commentary. It's one of our Lutheran commentators from a century ago. He says this shows that Paul went by way of the sea so they could not follow him and know where he was. So he's throwing them off his trail. And what happens is Silas and Timothy stay behind. Paul's the lightning rod. They get him out of there as quick as possible. He's got a couple or a handful of new converts who are accompanying him. And when they get to where they're going, those who conducted Paul, and after receiving a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible, they departed. So they know where Paul ends up. And then Paul sends them back and says, go secretly whisper in the ear of Silas and Timothy and tell them where I am so they can come join me. Okay? So that's what's happening here. So he's kind of secreted away and he lands in Athens. And that's where we're going to pick it up next time, next week. Okay? Because then in Athens, what does Paul do? He preaches some more and talks to more people. All right. Questions or comments?
It's true that it's easier for women, I suppose, to convert to Christianity, and yet the big giants of the faith are men. I mean, you know, the twelve apostles.
Yeah.
But you look, I mean, even all the these
you look
people,
at Mary Magdalene, she's a giant of the faith.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean, though.
You know what I mean.
Yeah.
Martin Luther, C.F.W. Walter, all these people. Plus, we do have the all-male clergy in our church, which I think is extremely important.
And we can talk about that sometime, because people will say, well, if Paul elevated women to being equal to men, why aren't there women pastors?
Oh, well,
that's a whole other discussion.
Oh, of course. So it's...
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. All right. So if you have thoughts or questions, write them down. I got to go talk to the preschool kids. Let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our
Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good day. By the